dirty game. Yeah. Know what I'm saying, Primo? Tell these niggas about my life, you know what I mean?
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bruce of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and on kwtf.net in Santa Rosa, California. The show is brought to you with support from Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan dishes, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. We're joined by Corey and Sophie from the mystical Pacific Northwest to speak about grand juries looming over the Pacific Northwest of the United States. The grand juries started up last March, and they look to continue to plague residents of Seattle and Portland areas for the next year or so. Can you all give a description of what grand juries are and how they operate?
Grand juries are made up of 16 to 23 state-selected peers. So we've got a grand jury being convened as of March 2012 in the Pacific Northwest, whose jurors were selected by the U.S. attorney who's prosecuting in this case. Throughout this grand jury process, as has already begun and will continue for the next year and a half plus, there'll be subpoenas that are targeting witnesses who are being asked to appear in front of the jury, as well as a judge and the prosecutor. And there are also subpoenas for things. In this case, we've got anarchist literature, anti-government literature, various articles of clothing, and electronic devices.
So how did this... So it's a court proceeding that's going against people who have these items on them. Is it just like an across the board full suppression of people with radical ideas, or may have radical implements or literature in their houses, or what's the purpose of this? Why are they convening this thing? And also, how is this different than a normal court proceeding? Like, what is the court difference?
A grand jury convenes in order to determine the substantiality behind felony or federal, rather, criminal cases. So a grand jury must approve the indictment of federal charges, federal criminal charges. So this grand jury is very clearly targeting anarchists in the Pacific Northwest, ranging from Portland to Olympia to Seattle and the surrounding areas, and targeting these people to this is so hard.
What are they targeting them for?
Well, in the history of a grand jury, going back to pre-colonial days in the United States of America, a grand jury has largely served the function of prosecuting and persecuting dissidents, anywhere from the American Indian movement to English loyalists during the American Revolution. And more recently, it's been used in Operation Backfire and the persecution of alleged green scare and eco-terrorist suspects. And now, most recently here in Seattle, we're looking at more of a general persecution of anarchists as radicals and dissidents. And this everything that we say here, you know, amounts to a lot of speculation. We're not actually clear as to what their intentions are. We're very limited in the scope of knowledge. What we do know is that they are citing anarchists specifically as the target of this federal investigation. The exact aims are unknown. What we do know is that they are particularly interested in seeking out information and trying to pursue charges against individuals allegedly involved in a May Day demonstration here in Seattle in the last year that resulted in quite a bit of damage, not only to banks and Nike Town and other corporate stores, but in particular to a Ninth Circuit federal courthouse of appeals. And that's the only specific locus point that we know of that they're interested in. It's been cited in the subpoenas that individuals have received. So we know that that's That is one of their main interest points. But we also do know that this grand jury was convened 2 months prior to this this damage. So it seems to be mostly a fishing expedition meant to entrap and chill associations amongst anarchists in the Northwest.
For the last 2 years in the Northwest, there has been a significant increase in dissidents from anarchists and their activity against the state as well as against the police. We've seen activity in Portland and Seattle predominantly prior to the Occupy movement, as well as throughout the Occupy movement, and then leading up to a port strike in December, and then sort of a grand finale, if you will, in May. The FBI have been interested in the activity of anarchists in the Northwest throughout that time. There's been contact between the FBI and federal law enforcement, down to local law enforcement, and repression has been clear, but is culminating in this grand jury as more substantial than we'd seen prior to the grand jury.
So how many, can you talk really briefly about the what the pre-Occupy involvement of anarchists around was? There are a lot of fudge the police rallies, right?
Yeah. In the summer of 2011, a record level of individuals were killed by the Seattle police and police in surrounding areas such as Tacoma, Washington, which is about an hour south of Seattle. And as this became more of a pattern of police violence, anarchists and other activists, but specifically anarchists, really took to the streets and picked up the gauntlet in order to really push an anti-police and an anti-police presence beyond the typical pretty reformist police anti-police brutality sentiments as espoused by more liberal and old leftist populations. And really what this looked like was a number of street demonstrations in the winter of 2011 that resulted in unscripted, unpermitted marches with minor property damage and so forth. And really, you know, the events themselves weren't as important as much as the after effects, which were to an extent the solidifying of pretty weak ties amongst anarchists in Seattle, in the Seattle area. It really brought people back together for probably the first time since the WTO demonstrations of 1999. And since the winter of 2011, anarchists have had a much more present face in the Seattle and Seattle area landscape. And of course, since then, we've been seeing a lot of state repression. It seems to be a pretty parallel response to the increase in anarchist presence in the area.
I think it's natural when we look at the history of the repression of dissidents throughout colonial territories. It's natural that you see when there is an obvious sense of camaraderie that's being shared between individuals that has real rippling effects. It was very obvious in the last 2 years, the increase of anarchist literature that was being shared, the increase of sabotage, and the increase of public social demonstration against the state, as well as the starting of a social center in Seattle for the first time, I believe, July or so of 2011, the opening of a social center. So, you know, it's natural that with all of this activity, all of this momentum and energy, people's spirits are extremely high. People are feeling satisfied, both personally and politically. People are feeling challenged and inspired. And this is, you know, so the last 2 years have been a huge breeding ground of, I guess, you know, the project against civilization or this Seattle society or whatnot. So, and it's natural that you're going to see repression when there's such an abundance of dissonance.
During this period of camaraderie and increased action and energizing among populations and new ties and connections, alongside of that, were people being continuing to have conversations around security culture and around, you know, were people's shields dropped in interaction with each other or in terms of surveillance? Or is it just, it's not so much that a chink in the armor was created as much as the state took the opportunity to start attacking because they didn't want that culture to build? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a hard question to address because obviously anarchy is not a formal organization. Rather, it's a tactic or a tendency that people choose to participate in wherever they are. So here, speaking as anarchists from the Northwest, I can't actually say that I know everyone involved and I know how people are conducting themselves in conversations. I can only really speak to my limited group of friends, which is an important note because what we did see in 2011 and certainly through the course of the Occupy movement was an increase in people just in raw numbers and ideas and things like that. So really, there's just been this massive spread of action and thought beyond any like personal knowledge. As far as security culture and how people are keeping safe, it's again, you know, a matter of degrees. And I can only say that I'm sure people who are familiar with that specific conversation and who've been around the milieu for a while have been practicing safety, but definitely there are individuals who perhaps are not. I think that what we actually are seeing is a level of repression on a much greater scale that really, you know, doesn't actually, no practice of security culture can keep you safe necessarily from some of this stuff. For instance, many of the people who have been subpoenaed for the grand jury, although their subpoena mentioned that they were the feds, the FBI, were interested in courthouse damage on May 1st, many of those individuals were not actually present in Seattle at all. So there's no real way that you can keep yourself safe from that. It's an extension of the law and repression that really can reach anywhere and into anyone's pocket and destroy anyone's life.
Can you all speak about who exactly has been targeted by the grand jury and how they've reacted to that and what the community response has been to those subpoenaed?
Yeah, on July 25th, houses were raided in Portland, Oregon, with the result of two individuals receiving subpoenas, Dennison Williams and Leah Lynn Plant. In the raids, they and their housemates had several items and articles confiscated, such as cell phones, quote-unquote radical or anarchist literature, which really needs to be noted that it's anywhere from, you know, the Portland Wobbly to, you know, wherever. And then on top of that, black clothing, hoodies, things like that, which I suppose we're led to believe are evidence of criminal behavior or something as absurd as that. And then beyond that, in the following months, three more subpoenas were served. Matt Duran and Katie Olajinek from Olympia, Washington, and most recently, Maddie Pfeiffer, also of Olympia, Washington. We also are aware of the fact that there are a number of subpoenas that are floating around, but the individuals to which they're supposed to belong have not actually been served, which is good. So since being served, the five individuals, at least initially, have very strongly chosen to not cooperate with the grand jury, and this has taken two forms. The most popular form, which four of the five participated in to some degree, we'll get into the specifics later, the exceptions rather, but the four chose to appear before the grand jury at their hearing date as witnesses and not answer questions beyond their name and their birthday, which are questions that the state already is aware of the answer, and it's just a formality. So having given name and birth date, the four, to varying degrees, would respond to questions. Some of the more common questions are, do you know person one or person two, or were you in May Day on this past May Day? Were you in Seattle? Things like that. And to those questions, the individuals would respond with a statement of non-cooperation, which usually looks like, I invoke my First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights not to testify. And then after going through that process, most individuals were taken to a contempt hearing for civil contempt for not cooperating with grand jury, at which point they were taken into federal detention for not cooperating. The fifth individual, Dennison Williams, chose not to cooperate by simply not appearing at the grand jury date that he was supposed to appear before. And he actually had his subpoena withdrawn. So he is currently not under a subpoena, which is good. At the risk of delving into a little bit of speculation, lawyers have suggested that this is most likely the reason that he has not been subpoenaed or faced any sort of contempt hearing is probably because he is a target of the grander investigation, which is bad.
What kind of support were the people, like, when they got called, getting, and where have the defendants gone with it?
Almost immediately, I believe, either the night of the initial July 25th raids or the day after, two websites were made in response, as a way to not only share information and updates, but also to broadcast what was going on to a larger sympathetic community. So we've got one website called saynothing.info, which has been a hub of resources and non-cooperating statements mostly, as well as various literature that's been written and broadcast in response to the grand jury. Then we've also got sort of a more of a committee. It's called Committee Against Political Repression. That's also out of the Northwest. And there are a number of people who have really come together and helped to garnish a lot of publicity for the non-cooperating resistors, helped to fundraise money for commissary as well as any travel expenses, any various expenses that the non-cooperating witnesses, those who have been subpoenaed and targeted by this grand jury, need.
And further, these two websites and the public support campaigns really provide an entry point for any individuals that we are not aware of who are targets of the investigation or the subpoenas. It provides them an entry point to reach out and look for support if they're confused and don't know what's going on, which is often the case in a grand jury. So that's a really important function. It's hard to measure how effective that's been, but that definitely is one of the intentions behind creating those portals.
So they folks invoke the First Amendment free speech, the Fourth Amendment against undue search and seizure, right? And then the Fifth, which is against self-incrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So because grand juries exist as a pre-constitutional leftover out of the British legal system, how do you get from invoking those things and not saying anything to the step of being considered in contempt?
So what defense for a subpoenaed witness essentially looks like is finding a lawyer, and the National Lawyers Guild, the NLG, as well as the Civil Liberties Defense Union, people such as Ben Rosenfeld, who have worked with Operation Backfire. So those two various organizations have been extremely supportive for witnesses, non-cooperating witnesses, as well as been supportive for just folks in the larger anarchist community seeking information and knowledge, and trying to figure out how to go about responding to this. So initially, most of those lawyers have attempted to buy time for their clients, which means filing various motions, attempting to quash the subpoena, and looking into further investigations of why this grand jury is going on and why their clients are being targeted specifically. Once a subpoenaed witness invokes their First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights, the judge presiding over the grand jury has can make the decision to grant them immunity.
So I guess more to answer your question more specifically, when a witness chooses to invoke their First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights, what they're trying to do is protect themselves from the secrecy of the investigation and its really deep probings. Oftentimes this doesn't really pan out for any number of reasons. The most common reason that we're encountering, that others have encountered, is a state tactic to grant immunity to the witness. So what this means is that if you are an individual appearing before a grand jury, when you're invoking your Fifth Amendment right to, against self-incrimination, there is a loophole immunity that the state will often try to exploit. So more specifically, if you do appear before the grand jury, you're often taken before a judge as well, and the judge can decide whether or not to grant you this immunity, whether or not you actually want it or not. So you could appear before this judge, and he will say, you know, I'm thinking about granting you immunity, and you can respond, you know, well, I'd rather not have immunity, but he can go ahead and do that if that's his decision, which it often is, because effectively immunity strips you of your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, because it's a legal tactic that says that any testimony that you provide before the grand jury actually cannot be used against you as evidence. So effectively, you can appear before a grand jury and say that you were present for this and that, or you engaged in some alleged activity, and then that actually can't be turned back against you. However, this doesn't mean that you cannot be a target of the investigation. You can have immunity. You can say whatever you need to say, and they can still seek you out later for indictments or whatever. They just can't use the specific testimony against you. So it really, all it does achieve is it's a specific kind of fish tackle in this fishing expedition. It kind of grants people this sense of comfort that they go in and that they're offered immunity, so it's not as scary anymore. They can say things and not fear repercussions, which I said, you know, is not true. But it also prevents people from actually challenging the grand jury in a legal form by invoking their amendment rights.
So there's one person who was served and they decided to have a conversation with prosecutors, right? They decided to, or do we know if Leal Implant has actually worked with the state in this case? What do we know at this point?
So currently there are two imprisoned non-cooperating resistors that went in, I believe, mid-September. Shortly after that time, Leal Implant, who was one of the initial folks, served a subpoena in Portland on July 25th, was resubpoenaed several times, and then finally, I believe on August or October 12th, that is, had a contempt hearing, was found to be in contempt of court by the judge presiding over the grand jury trial, and was immediately brought to the federal detention center where all of the non-cooperating witnesses were brought, located just in SeaTac, just south of Seattle, and was held there for 4 days prior to seeking out her lawyer and asking for essentially a way out. The only way to not be found in contempt of court is obviously by cooperating with the court and what the court asks you to do. In this case, it asks you to appear before the grand jury members. So on this fourth day, Leal Implant was resubpoenaed by the prosecutors, the U.S. attorney, and appeared before the grand jury, was asked several questions by the prosecutor, obviously including the formalities of name, birthday, etc. But then going into some amount of questioning and answering, enough so that she was found to no longer be in contempt of court and thus became a cooperating witness. We know little of the questions that she answered, and based on extensive history of cooperating witnesses and what information they share, we know that if someone cooperates, they're never going to come clean, so to speak, about what it is they've told, what questions, in fact, they've answered, and anyone's names that they've confirmed or freely given. So we know little of what information she shared. We know that because she became a cooperating witness after 4 days, it looks, this only proves to the judge as well as the jurors that holding people while they're in civil contempt of court is in fact coercive, which is a really big threat to the other non-cooperating witnesses.
Well, Leah is a really difficult subject to talk about because there has been a lot of speculation surrounding this matter, and we have to be really careful in this discussion because, like my co-presenter here said, we know very little. We essentially know nothing other than the very limited amount that she's decided to share with people. And this is the scariest aspect of the Leah situation, is that she did serve 4 days, as my co-presenter said, and was released, and 3 days went by before the support committee that has provided a lot of material and emotional support for her actually knew that she was released. And when that became known, people attempted to contact her and get some sort of story from her to know a little bit more about what was said and what she said, because obviously this is really sensitive and could be potentially very damaging, not only for direct individuals, but for the greater community that really needs a lot of like strength and solidarity right now. What we do know, according to Leah, is that she answered pretty benign questions, such as identifying a Circle A as an anarchy symbol, or identifying an individual as a, quote, neo-Nazi infiltrator of Portland radical circles. Beyond that, nothing else is known, what she said, and she's chosen not to describe anything further, citing safety, an ambiguous safety. We're not sure what kind of safety, as the reason why she isn't more public with or more forthcoming with information.
But really, she's in like a very difficult bind, because even if she didn't say anything more than that, there's no way, like Sophie was saying, there's no way to know for sure what was being said during the proceedings.
It's also a threat because she is obviously now a cooperating witness and can continue to be so throughout the course of this grand jury.
To really reiterate, the grand jury model thrives. It depends entirely upon secrecy. That is supposedly what it's supposed to do, you know, is grant complete security for its witnesses, meaning that none of the testimony is ever made public. But this is really a double bind, like you're saying, Bruce, because Leah could have essentially gone in and laid down an anarchy dictionary of every alliance that she's aware of, or any individual, or their address, or anything. She could have told them everything she knows, and we would never know that. So that's what's scary here, is that she could have flown to that extreme, or she could have responded exactly as she said she responded. But because we don't know, effectively all that happens is this really widespread paranoia and sense of abandonment and disappointment and fear, that's really damaging to people. And I can only imagine what it's done to those who are actually choosing to remain non-cooperative on the inside.
And that brings us to two of the resistors, Matt Duran and Katie Olgenick. And they have both been, they've been simple as well as outspoken, but really firm in their stance to not cooperate. They really understand not only the endangerment that puts themselves in, but really are looking out for everyone else, their friends and their family, their comrades, And obviously the large number of strangers that they really don't know or have a personal relationship, but that who would be and could be and are currently being affected by this grand jury and state repression in general. They've been writing letters and getting updates. People from all over the world are writing them letters, offering their support. Lots of spells are being cast, not only against this grand jury, but also for their protection and their stability, which is really what we need. We need non-cooperating witnesses who understand that the risk of jail and their imprisonment is something that you have to endure when you're a dissident, when you're seeing things in the world that you hate and want to destroy. You have to understand that spending time in jail is something that is possible and most likely. And both KDO and Matt Duran, as well as Maddie Pfeiffer, whose contempt hearing will be held on December 14th of 2012, these people really understand that being stable and being strong, both emotionally and mentally, are going to be very important for themselves during imprisonment, as well as being encouraging to each other. They're constantly asking their lawyers, how's KDO doing? How's Matt doing? They want to know how their other non-cooperating witnesses and comrades are doing. And they care about each other, and they care about the people on the outside who are giving so much support, who are figuring out not only legal strategies, but also anarchist responses to this grand jury.
We've been speaking with Sophie and Corey, two anarchists from the Pacific Northwest, about the grand jury's convening against anarchists since starting in March of 2012. More after this musical break. Yeah, don't they know it's dangerous in these streets? Don't they know it's gangs of us? We roll deep, we OGs, fill up the whole deep. L with the flows, the L with the beats, L in the robo. It's over for hold these. The reason we hold things, there's no peace in the streets with the police in the streets. Yo, it's cops that old niggas dope for O's and keys. It's more than a beef with the 5-0 in the streets with the 5-0. It's a game of survival. And who protects me from you when I got peeps who rock text and weed from you? And all the niggas see in the news is cop corruption. Niggas getting popped for nothing, and niggas getting stopped. The cops pull out blocks and bust them. Y'all need to get shot for nothing, cause we don't hold back, we let go. We don't say damn, we just say whoa. We're back to our conversation with Corey and Sophie, who are visiting North Carolina from the Pacific Northwest to talk to folks about the grand juries convened against anarchists and some ways that folks have resisted them. Can you talk a little bit about what, so you've mentioned the support in the form of letters and correspondence with the individuals on the inside. You've talked about people raising money for commissaries and things like that, and probably, I assume for some legal defense funding, even though those two organizations are doing support. Can you talk a little bit about the revolutionary solidarity stuff that's happened globally?
Yeah, really what we've seen since, you know, the end of July when this really started rolling is massive international solidarity with the resistors and with the Northwest more generally. This ranges from graffiti in Athens to police vehicles being torched and attacked in anywhere from like St. Louis to Atlanta to Vancouver, BC. It's really been all over the board. France, Spain. It's massive, and it's continual, which is probably more important because what we're looking at here, you know, currently is a 24-month investigation, 2 solid years. So March 2014 is supposedly when this is over. Could be extended to 3 if this is a special grand jury. We don't know. But really, solidarity needs to be ongoing throughout that period if it's going to be effective. If it's going to be this short, fiery burst here at the beginning and then peter out towards the middle, that could be very problematic because the individuals serving time right now for civil contempt could turn out like Leah if they feel uncared for or especially alienated. Who knows what psychological damage is being done to them. And we need to be really supportive throughout this whole thing, keep everyone really strong and healthy. So yeah, solidarity has been, it's overwhelming. And I know that it's been really great for those who are actually on the inside right now and for those who are preparing to go in.
For those outside of the case who have been in the Northwest, like you said, that some of the solidarity actions have been taken in the name of people, of anarchists in the Northwest in general. Can you talk about what kind of support, as much as you can talk about it, as much like what kind of mutual aid and support and just shoring up of communities people are involved in the Northwest? Or is that more of a doesn't belong on the radio type thing? Because it's got to be stressful with this chilling effect of floating subpoenas. That sounds dirty. Floating subpoenas and like not knowing where those are going, you know? So how have people been, what have you heard about people like taking care of themselves and also keeping strong and keeping community ties when there's so much possibility for paranoia?
You know, I'd like to say that this hasn't had a massive chilling effect on anarchists in the Northwest, but the reality is that it has, and it's been a really hard thing for people to deal with. It's very isolating and alienating. But I do know that there have been a few things that stand as statements to the resistors, but also probably to the anarchists in the Northwest themselves. There was a pretty flash mob style demonstration in downtown Portland that began just about as quickly as it ended, that resulted in damage to multiple banks and general mayhem and wildness that I think I can only imagine was really solidifying and strengthening for people who feel really impacted and damaged by what's going on. And I guess we've seen this across the board, anything from as small as like a banner drop to attacks on courthouses, now more in a clandestine night style. I can only imagine, I can't speak for it personally, but I can only imagine that these actions are not simply meant as symbolic reach out to those inside or those that are avoiding subpoenas or what have you, but also as statements for oneself to really feel like even though the might of the state is really on people's backs right now, it is really, you know, as they say, easy to attack and easy to experience moments of liberation and joyous destruction, even in the wake of massive repression.
I also feel like, on the contrary, when our friends and each other are able to show up for each other and be really strong and caring and loving, that only fuels your hatred for that which wants to take that away from you. So people have been like talking and hanging out and going on walks in the woods and encouraging each other in our ideas of who we want to be as humans and everything that gets in the way of that, which is obviously the function of the state and the legal system. So that's looked like a whole lot of, you know, befriending, a lot of, you know, fireside conversation to build warmth and camaraderie. And it's, you know, it takes the form of mothering, you know, showing up to our friends' houses with food that they can stick in the oven because you know that they're too huffing and busy to do that themselves right now. It means offering childcare, you know, it means like showing up for your friends when you know that they are having to deal with such an overwhelming situation that all the mundane things of life suddenly fall by the wayside, you know. So as friends and as alliances and comrades, like showing up and taking care of those things so that they can really focus on having enough energy to prepare themselves or whatever regard.
So you both made the point so far that the grand jury system is based on secrecy, and that's where the power lies for it. It paralyzes communities because they can't defend themselves using constitutional backing of First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment. They're granted immunity in that, supposedly, although it could really come back to bite them in the patukas afterwards. I just made that word up. But can we talk a little bit about how the media and how lawyers have been able to get a hold of this information from the sealed grand jury?
Yeah, there have been a couple ways that information about this specific grand jury have been gleaned. One was a FOIA request submitted by the Civil Liberties Defense Union in Eugene, Oregon, to try to uncover more specifics about the scope of this investigation. And from that, really all we learned was that it's at least a 24-month convening, 2 years, and that it was convened in March 2012, as we've said. Those are two actually very interesting pieces of information, but it's really all we got. The second thing that the media has done, or outside sources have done to obtain information, is a little bit more fishy. We know that the affidavits for this investigation are very tightly sealed. According to lawyers, they're actually unusually tightly sealed, more than historically.
The affidavits are the documents that detail the reasons and discussion for the preceding trial.
Right. So basically, the affidavit is the scope of the investigation and its interest point. That's a good note to make. These tightly sealed, secretive affidavits were what we're told accidentally unsealed for a very brief moment of time when they were accessed by the Seattle PI, one of Seattle's largest news sources, and the Seattle Times. Nudge, nudge, they were leaked to the media for whatever purpose.
Part of it was, not the entire thing, part of it.
Right, part of the affidavit was unsealed. And from this portion, which, you know, was later tightly sealed again, and is unobtainable even from the media outlets, we learned that the FBI was tailing Portland activists prior to May Day for some length of time, and alleging that these specific individuals traveled from Portland to Olympia, Washington the day before the May Day protests. So that would have been April 30th, 2012. Which they are then using as grounds for what they seem to be trying to pursue as a felony interstate travel with the intent to riot. They also have targeted these individuals further when they raided homes and obtained cell phones, from which they gleaned a few text messages saying things like May Day was fun or it was a blast or whatever. And then the media tried to paint that as a portrait of guilt of something.
Another unlikely indictment that those targeted by this grand jury are going to be facing is some sort of conspiracy charge. Conspiracy charges are often used by the government to connect a lot of individuals with either known or unknown associations to each other and charge them with criminal intent in acting against the government or its property or some sort of private space in general. Also, conspiracy can be used for some sort of thought crimes, as in the case with Eric McDavid.
And we've seen like a growing prevalence of conspiracy trials come up around the United States over the last 7 years or so, including the Asheville 11 case, which is ongoing here in North Carolina. When FOIA or Freedom of Information Act papers end up getting released, usually there's a high degree of redaction or blacking out of names and information on there. Is it possible, and maybe I am totally speculating right now, but is it possible that the people who were tracked by the FBI agents weren't necessarily the same who were served with subpoenas, that the subpoenaing process and the raiding process are a fishing expedition because of the nature of grand juries and because it's about naming people and getting off and then those people name other people, that those people who were tracked initially by the FBI starting in March were different than the people who have been focused on since May Day, and it's been an expansion of of the grand jury's purpose?
It's pretty obvious based on the number of subpoenas that have been issued, not necessarily the number that have actually been served, but the number that have issued that we're aware of at this point. It's very obvious that they're fishing around, like you were saying, that they're starting with a large popcorn number of people to try to get as much information and as much cooperation in whatever form as they can get. So when you're subpoenaed as a witness for a grand jury, you're listed as such, a witness. You can also become or be listed as a target of the investigation. In the initial rounds of subpoenas, people have been listed as only witnesses of the grand jury. However, in the most recent subpoena issued to Maddie Pfeiffer, they were listed as not only a witness, but as a target. So this is potentially this is rather speculative, but this is potentially the time that the scope of the investigation is going to begin narrowing itself.
So say one of our listeners or one of their friends or associates or family members or lovers or whatever is subpoenaed before a grand jury. What should they do? What steps should they take? Who should they contact, and what should they say? What should they not say?
Well, the thing is, if somebody does receive a subpoena, really non-cooperation is the only option. As if there were any options. Cooperation is just not on the table as far as we're concerned. Because obviously non-cooperation or cooperation with the grand jury investigation really can only harm. It's obviously not meant to help anyone or make anybody better off than they were previously. So, non-cooperation is the only option. And this can take many forms. And we've only really talked about two today. We talked about appearing before the grand jury and refusing to answer questions that would be potentially incriminating. And we've talked about simply not appearing, as in the case of Dennis and Williams. Really, those are the only two we've seen in the Northwest. Beyond that, there hasn't really been too much experimentation. I have heard from lawyers that in the past, individuals have chosen to avoid being subpoenaed altogether when they become aware of the fact that they're the FBI is attempting to contact them. It's risky to do such because there are laws on the books that could try you for
evasion
of a subpoena. That being said, no one's ever actually gone to trial for that. Basically what I'm trying to get at is that I couldn't recommend any one particular direction. Everyone should pursue acts of non-cooperation as seems suitable for their situation. What they should do is immediately try to contact a lawyer, either through the NLG or otherwise, and then from that point on, try to figure out their options.
Prior, in fact, to contacting a lawyer, if you are being served papers, they, number one, have to serve them directly to the person that they're issued for. So person A cannot receive person B's subpoena. That is not valid.
Unless they're a direct family member. If you're married and you're living with your spouse or living with your parents or immediate family, such as a brother or sister.
Also, anyone talking with an agent of any form should, in fact, request a business card and say strictly, I need to contact my lawyer. Do you have a business card that I can get from you so that my lawyer can contact you? Establishing this sort of formality rather than in any way presenting a level of vulnerability is going to be really important. And it's also, that hopefully is going to be an easy thing to remember when you're, being terrorized in whatever form by the FBI.
So pretty much the same realm as if you were being stopped by a regular cop on the street or an immigration officer or Secret Service or whatever. Just, I'm going to remain silent. I want to speak with an attorney, or let me get this card. I'm going to speak with an attorney. Even if you don't have an attorney, there are projects that will, like the Center for Constitutional Law and the National Lawyers Guild and the other, what was the other one that you named?
Civil Liberties Defense Union. Also, in addition to what we've said, obviously these are those are relating to grand juries or dealing with law enforcement in general. But specifically with this case, again, to reiterate, there's both SayNothing.info as well as the Committee Against Political Repression. That can be those can be very worthwhile resources, not only for broadcasting information, but as well for establishing connections with people who have long been working on this case.
Which is incredibly important because one of the major effects of a grand jury investigation is that it could chill your social relationships. So it's really important for people to really be public in forthcoming with their information, letting people know that they have received a subpoena, that they are in some degree being pursued by the state. And then from there, moving on to figuring out strategies for support and also non-cooperation, because this in doing so, an individual could severely limit the amount of paranoia and speculation that would really isolate an individual and really damage them publicly and interpersonally.
It's also really important that if you feel that you're a part of this community that we're discussing, either anarchist or activist in some way, that and you feel that the threat of law enforcement is upon you, then really paying attention to your surroundings and discussing with your friends and housemates that you have about how to deal with these situations as they arise, how to deal with forms of surveillance, as well as any visitations that you may receive. Talking with people that you're close with is going to be really important so that you're going to have you're going to be able to prepare and encourage each other and hopefully not endure as much shock.
And that degree of transparency too and communication also allows for the other folks around you to make choices and be informed around their own decisions. And like if someone doesn't feel like because, okay, so say person A has been communicated with by has been served a subpoena, that means that they are the visible like recipient of state surveillance and communication at this point. It allows other people around you to take that information and know to be extra safe and extra careful because your community is under increased surveillance and attempted penetration by the federal government too. So it's kind of a consent thing too. Yes.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's really important for individuals who have been subpoenaed or feel that they are a subject of a subpoena to really realize that they're not the it's not personal necessarily. It's not really about them. They're not just the subject of the investigation itself or the only target. It's really about realizing that anarchists or activists more broadly are the target, and then trying to like figure out that, you know, the actions that an individual takes beyond receiving a subpoena don't only affect them personally, but affect, you know, whoever the FBI is trying to deal damage to or oppress or whatever. There is a level of sort of community stakes in this issue, and people really have to remember that. And that's really what's disappointing about Leah Lynn Plant's cooperation.
So we talked about ways that people within the community can support the resistors right now by, you know, just writing letters and things like that, and coming out to court and showing visual support that way, and the way that people on the international stage have shown support through revolutionary solidarity actions of burning cop cars or putting up banners or graffiti in Greece. Can we talk about fundraising, and can we talk about also the immediate needs of some of the folks, like as far as their health concerns?
A couple things that you can do for the people on the inside directly to affect them are going to be to write letters, send them books through a formal bookstore. You can write them letters, have books sent to them. You can donate to their commissary, which you can figure out based on Committee Against Political Repression. There's a lot of information on that website regarding how to go about doing so. There's also various fundraisers, various products that you can buy to contribute to the larger fund for currently Matt and KDO and soon to be future others. In addition to this, writing the letters and donating to commissary, there's also the Quiet Coyote, which is a well of money for the non-cooperating witnesses to receive after released from jail, assumingly in March of 2014, potentially later. So again, the fund is called Quiet Coyote, and donating to that will help contribute to their life as they emerge from the inside to the outside. This program is actually really exciting to be doing right now, as it falls in the week of the International Call for Solidarity for Grand Jury Resistors. Anarchists around the world have faced repression from the government for its entire history, and this week is a special call out to people who feel affinity with and sympathetic with what is going on in the Pacific Northwest, either because they've experienced it themselves or simply, you know, for any number of other reasons. So this week, November 12th through the 19th, there's been an international call for solidarity. So that means, you know, having discussions like this, really talking about what it means to be repressed by an authoritarian government. And, yeah.
And how we can feel strong.
Mm-hmm. How to stick up for ourselves and you know, how to keep living in, keep making spaces that we want to see and keep destroying those that we don't.
Yeah, it's also really important to note, too, that Matt Duran, who is in federal detention right now, is vegan. He's a longtime vegan, and the Federal Detention Center in SeaTac does not provide vegan options as part of the meal program there. So essentially what he has to do in order to maintain a vegan diet is to spend his commissary money on vitamins and small vegan treats, and anything really that he can subsist on. And that's incredibly difficult to do. So people have been calling the warden of the prison to try to secure vegan options for Matt and other vegan prisoners, which is probably a worthwhile exercise. As well as donating to his commissary so he can continue to get the nutritional support in as far as he can.
And at the end of this, I'll tack on a little bit of information, the phone number and who to ask for at the SeaTac detention facility to be able to get Matt that food and the vitamins. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thanks for hosting us.
Yeah. Woo! Solidarity means attack. We've been speaking with Corey and Sophie, two anarchists from the Pacific Northwest, about the grand juries against anarchists that seem like they might continue until March 2014. To express concerns for the safety and health of the grand jury resistors, one could call SeaTac FDC Warden Jack Fox at 206-870-5700 and request that Matt Duran have access to healthful vegan food and communicate concern for Catherine Olejnik. More info can be found at nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com and saynothing.noblogs.org. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and on kwtf.net from Santa Rosa, California. This show is brought to you with support from Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan dishes, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. Have a great week.